Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do you know your own kids? Well enough to know or at least guess when they become sexually active? This era of intensive parenting encourages efforts to understand our children better than any generation of parents before us. And many moms and dads are confident they have taught their kids well enough to avoid what they see as the hazards of teenage sex. But as my guest today has learned from talking to families, the source of that confidence may be little more than a blind spot in our parental vision. Seneca Elliott is assistant professor of sociology at North Carolina State University and author of the new book, Not My Kid, What Parents Believe About the Sex Lives of Their Teenagers. Seneca, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So we feel very smart as parents in understanding that, yes, teenagers do have sex. What makes us all believe that our own kids are the exception?
Yeah. Well, when people tell me, wow, parents are really in denial about their own kids, I turn it around. I ask them, when's the last time you heard anything positive about teens and sex? Hmm. And there's not an answer, because we don't hear much that's positive about teen sexuality, but we hear a whole lot that's negative. So we hear about teen pregnancy. We hear about sexually transmitted infections, promiscuity, deviance, raging hormones. And, of course, parents look at their kids and they don't see them in those negative ways. But I also think they don't want those negative things for their kids, obviously.
So looking at our children as sexual beings essentially means we have failed if they are under a certain age.
Yes, absolutely. I think that that's what parents were telling me, that my kid isn't doing those things. My kid isn't interested in those things. You know, in fact, I look at my kid and I see that they're really immature compared to their peers. And I think that alleviates some of parents' concerns. And I think it also allows parents to present their teens as good kids, and which, you know, generally we do tend to see our kids as good kids because they're our kids.
And again, your argument is not that kids who have sex are not necessarily good kids, simply that that's the way we tend to perceive them.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. That we're not having conversations about teens who have sex responsibly. It turns out teens are, many of them, having sex in a very responsible manner. But we're not hearing as much about that.
Let's talk about that. There is this sort of old idea, or I should say long-standing idea, that it's one thing for an adult to have a sex life and sort of be in control, but kids are you know, they become like animals and they have these raging hormones and they cannot control their sexual urges.
Yes, yeah. So one of the things I talk about in the book is that some of the ideas we have about sex being especially dangerous for teens has to do with how we think about teenagers. Their maturity or really lack thereof, and their ability to act responsibly. We don't really have a very flattering picture of teens' maturity and responsibility. We have this idea that they're vessels of raging hormones. They lack the ability to self-regulate. They're thrill seekers. And I think especially when it comes to teenage boys, that they're risk takers. So given these ways of thinking about teens, I think many parents told me that it would essentially be negligent on their part to talk about, for example, the pleasures that can come from sex, or just even talk openly about these things.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you had lots of parents who had varying levels of comfort in engaging their kids in a discussion about sex, but most of them had tried. But the one thing that made everybody sort of blanch was when you said, well, have you talked to them about the pleasures of sex?
Yeah, and I explicitly asked parents this, and some of them, I had one mother who just started laughing, and she just laughed so hard when I said this, as if the question was so naive and so incredibly absurd. Most said, wow, I haven't even thought about that. That would be really risky, and I had parents who said, that just seems morally wrong. And parents who said, they're getting a lot of information about pleasure. You turn on the TV, you know, look on any billboard, they're seeing images of pleasure, so my job is to teach them about risk and danger. But I did have a few parents who very thoughtfully said, yeah, we have had those conversations. One mother said she thought it was easier to have those conversations when her children were younger. She found that as her kids got older and moved into adolescence, that they really resisted those conversations. And she said it kind of generated the ew factor because she thought that as they started to think more about what this meant, they might be thinking about their own parents doing these things.
Yeah, are parents afraid that having these conversations, you know, if you ask for information about your kids' private sex lives, are they going to ask you for questions about your own?
Absolutely. I think they are. And most parents I talked to said that their teens were put off by these conversations and just said, hey, I don't want to hear this information. I don't need this information, and I especially don't want to get it from you. Mm-hmm. But I did have a couple of parents who said he had the temerity to ask me about my sex life, and that's where I said, well, no, this is private. We're not going there. And I think that that speaks volumes. If we want our teenagers to talk openly about their sex lives with us, we need to be prepared for them to start asking us questions as well. And yeah.
Seneca, do kids today have significantly more sex than their parents did? Are we holding them, this generation, to a different standard than we held ourselves to at the same age?
No. Kids aren't having significantly more sex than their parents did. We're not holding them to a different standard. And a lot of the parents I spoke with had sex as teens and remembered it in a variety of different ways. Some of them said, I had sex as a teen, and it didn't ruin my life. In fact, I thought it was a worthwhile thing to do because it helped me figure out what I liked and didn't like. I had parents who said, I had sex as a teen, and it was a mistake, and I really want my teenager to avoid repeating that mistake. So the parents I talked with had complicated sexual histories, we're using those as a guide in thinking about and hoping for their own children's sexual lives.
Was there anything like a universal age at which parents thought, okay, it really is entirely my child's decision, and whether I approve or disapprove, it's up to them? Was that 18?
A lot of parents did say that they would consider their children adults at 18, but they had a caveat, which is at 18, and if they're financially and emotionally independent. So parents saw not so much a particular age as being key for their children to be old enough and mature enough to perhaps venture into sex, but also particular symbolic markers, things like going to college. That was a big one for parents, and I think it makes sense. College represents an achievement in our culture. It means that their kids have done well enough in school, have applied themselves, and have gotten into a system of higher education where they're going to improve their odds on the labor market later in life. And it also means that they're moving out of the parental home, most likely, and they're not going to be under the parents' direct supervision, and so I think that changes the parents' sense of their level of accountability for their teen's well-being. So there's more of a, okay, at that point, I'm not going to be omnipresent. And I also think many parents did still say that they preferred that their teens wait until they're married to have sex. And I think there should be some context for my interviews. I've interviewed parents in a state where abstinence until marriage is a very strong initiative. And so that was a big part of the story parents were telling me, was that abstinence really is one of the only ways young people can be safe and healthy
I was interested to read this, that there are more similarities, though, than people might imagine between the messages of abstinence-only education and the messages of more comprehensive sex education.
Yes, absolutely. And that was one of the most surprising things, I think. What got me interested in this work in the first place was that I attended some public school board meetings where a student health textbook was being debated. And the big topic of debate was whether the student health textbook should have information about contraception so that students would have that information in their textbooks. And so this was a debate against abstinence, where we really just need to hammer home the message of abstinence, or contraception. Students, young people need information about contraception. So people were up in arms. It was a very divisive debate. And yet as I sat and listened to them, I thought, even though there's this huge disagreement, what they're saying sounds very similar. On either side of the aisle, people were saying teens either need information about contraception to be safe, or they need to abstain to be safe. So it all came down to the risks, the dangers that sex poses to teens. And in contrast, the parents I spoke with were far more uncertain. So I had parents say, abstinence is best, and then they would follow up with, but it's not realistic. I don't think that teens are going to abstain, but I would really prefer that that was the case for my teen.
What do parents identify as the things that frighten them about the idea of teenagers having sex or being sexually active, in whether that's intercourse or in other ways?
I think that there's pregnancy, STIs, and even heartbreak. So parents talked about sex as kind of emotionally derailing their teens, throwing them off course, and ruining their future. Parents have this negative portrait of sexually active teens as not future-focused, as not good academics even. And so they want to keep their own children kind of on a straight and narrow path. Focus on your studies, get an education so that you can get a good job, and then you can live a happy and fulfilling life.
So did parents have a sense that they could look into a crowded room of teenagers and point to the ones that are sexually active and the ones that are not?
Certainly, I found that parents were constructing the sexually active teenager in very stereotypical ways. So parents would talk about the pregnant children at their teenager's school. And, you know, they would say that, you know, you don't want to be like that person. And they weren't just talking about the pregnancy, but, you know, unfortunately they were talking about those teens as the ones who let those hormones get away from them, who made those bad decisions that are ultimately going to make their lives so much harder.
Seneca Elliott is my guest. She's assistant professor of sociology at North Carolina State University and author of the new book, Not My Kid, What Parents Believe About the Sex Lives of Their Teenagers. We welcome you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Thank God on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Seneca Elliott. She's assistant professor of sociology at North Carolina State University and author of the new book, Not My Kid, What Parents Believe About the Sex Lives of Their Teenagers. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Seneca, I'll confess that as a parent, I have very complicated feelings about all of this, as I'm sure many parents coming to your work do. But reading the book, I was struck by the fact that most parents encourage their kids to, say, take driver's ed and learn to drive and operate a car despite the clear and present danger. How is it that we learn to sort of trust their judgment behind the wheel, doing something that could get them killed, but sex feels different to us?
Oh, that's so interesting. And I actually had a mother who made this analogy, a mother I interviewed for the book. She said to me she thinks that driving is safer for her teen sons than is sex. And she said to me, I can teach my sons how to drive, but I can't teach them how to. And then she stopped. You know, she pulled back from that. And what she was going to say was, I can't teach them how to have sex. And I think she felt that that was very graphic and that was a taboo thing to say. And, of course, it is, because I think that I like to say that in our culture, sex is everywhere and nowhere. So sex is glamorized. It's all over our culture. And yet it's not really talked about. And there is, in fact, a lot of shame around talking about sex. And so parents would often stumble or stutter over the word sex. They avoided using anatomically correct terms for genitalia. They would use things like private parts and down there. And so I think there's this larger feeling that sex is something private, sex is something shameful, sex is something different. It's outside of the public realm. And that really drives some of this concern and uncertainty that parents are feeling.
So it can be difficult in our society for parents and their teenagers to have open and frank conversations about sex. It sounds like in any situation. But I'm especially curious about what you learned about parents of LGBT teens and those teenagers and the conversations they were able to have. I was struck by the fact that parents, even parents who said, I'd be fine if I learned that my son or daughter was gay or lesbian, but they always assumed that that was not the case.
Right. So most parents, when I talked about sex, they thought that meant sexual intercourse, heterosexual intercourse. And in their conversations with their teens about sex, they focus on heterosexual intercourse. And most of them think about their teens as being straight, as being heterosexual, and those conversations revolved around the perils or the dangers that the opposite sex would pose to their kids. Some parents did say when I asked them explicitly about, you know, how would they feel if their kids were gay. Parents said, of course, I'd be fine with it. But parents also expressed some misgivings about that. They said, I would rather that they weren't because it makes life harder. So I think parents are really invested in their teens having good lives, having it easy. But when we construct particular challenges as negative, as making life harder rather than as possible positive things, as things that can make us better people, that can make us more interesting, then I think we kind of narrow the options.
So what did you learn about where, I mean, do teens who are gay and lesbian talk to their parents even less about what they may be thinking? I mean, do they wait until they're sort of ready to come out?
I didn't have many parents telling me that their teens had come out. I spoke with a father who expressed some concern that his son might be gay because he had found him watching gay porn. Mm-hmm. But he also said, I don't think he's gay because I think he's more concerned about this son has apparently worried on a long-term basis about his penis size, and the father thought he might be watching gay porn so that he could see other penises and see how his penis measures up. So I'm not sure that parents are hearing from their teens, the ones at least that I spoke with, that they may be having same-sex feelings.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Larry in Fort Worth. Hi, Larry.
Hello. So I'm definitely on the side of comprehensive sex education, and I don't have too much trouble talking with my kids about the mechanics. But I was interested that you haven't brought up my big fear about sex and teenagers, which is kind of unintentional intimacy. You know, you bring this person home, they're in your dorm room, they're driving your car, have access to your wallet, and all you really know about them is he looks hot in those jeans. So I wonder if other parents had that concern as well.
Thanks for your call.
I couldn't hear all of it. She said unintentional intimacy?
Yeah, so in other words, you are attracted to somebody, you bring them home, you bring them to your dorm room, and suddenly they're driving your car, and they know where your wallet is, and they because of the sex, you have a suddenly very close relationship with someone that you don't necessarily know well. And she wanted to know if other parents had worries like that as well.
Oh, yeah, actually, I think a lot of parents kind of see sex as something that creates this tight bond, or that can lead to this intense relationships. And for the parents I was talking to had teenagers, typically in high school, some in middle school, and so what they were thinking about was primarily that these tight emotional bonds might prevent their teens from building their social networks, from continuing to see other people, have a diverse group of friends, be social, participate in extracurricular activities, and keep their head down and on their books. So I'm not quite sure if that's what the caller was asking, but that parents did see sex as something that would lead to close emotional bonds, and then also that could make it harder for young people to sever those bonds. So that's when I talked earlier about pregnancy, STIs, and heartbreak. Because we invest sex with a lot of power in our culture, I think parents saw if their teens were engaged in a relationship that included sex, that would be an especially painful, difficult relationship to end.
What kinds of warnings did you find parents giving their teenagers about the young rogues and vixens that might be leading their good girls and their sweet boys into trouble?
Yeah, this was kind of a troubling part of my research, that parents really use a battle of the sexes kind of way of talking to their teens about the dangers of sex with the opposite sex. So I had parents who referred to girls as sluts, who would say to their sons, You have the slut and you have the nice girl. You need to make the distinction. You don't want to end up with a slut. I had parents who said to their sons that you have to really watch out for girls. Some of them use sex to trap you. And I had, of course, parents who talked to their daughters about how boys are just after one thing. I had a parent who used the phrase, why pay for the cow when you can get the milk for free, when he talked with his daughter about sex and boys. So I do think that parents are mischaracterizing their children's peers in these pretty negative ways. But I do want to point out that it's partly because of their fears and their hopes. And so they have anxieties about their teen's well-being, and they also have really big hopes and wishes for their well-being and their futures.
Have we lost the double standard that says that boys should be free to go out and pursue sex as they choose, and girls are only nice girls if they always say no?
Well, I don't think we have, but I didn't see that happening in these interviews with parents. Parents of sons and parents of daughters uniformly said, sex is dangerous for my kid. My kid's not like other kids, isn't interested in having sex. So there's a double meaning to the title of my book, Not My Kid. It's not just that parents are saying my teen isn't having sex, but also that my teen isn't one of those teens who is having sex.
Hmm.
They don't have a particularly favorable impression of sexually active, quote-unquote, sexually active teens.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Linda in Fort Worth. Hi, Linda.
Hello. You kind of got ahead of me because I was going to ask a question about gay teenagers and how they fit into this dialogue, because oftentimes I think they're kind of out on their own, having to make these kinds of decisions by themselves without much guidance from parents or other adults. You did cover some of that. I just wanted to comment that girls, gay teenage girls, are at such a low risk of sexually transmitted diseases and at no risk of pregnancy, but they are at huge risk for terrible heartbreak because of the emotional intensity. So I think that it's incumbent on parents to be at least somewhat open-minded about the possibility that their kids might either be gay or might be wondering about it.
Mm-hmm. And in a separate study that I did, I interviewed only fathers who had teenage sons and daughters, and I was especially interested in this question of sexual orientation. And what I found interesting was that this particular group of fathers seemed more willing to embrace and acknowledge that their daughters might be lesbian, but less willing, more close-minded to the thought that their sons might be gay. But at the same time that they did that, they didn't really seem to think that teenage girls who identified as lesbian were being authentic. And I think that we've created this larger, I'm not sure if your listeners have heard this, but there's this larger story now about teenage girls or college-aged girls who experiment with bisexuality, for example,
mm-hmm.
or experiment with their sexual identity. And it in some ways kind of negates that they're authentically sexual.
Like it's a phase they're going through.
Exactly, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone to Ed, calling from Flower Mound. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Chris. Another great show.
Thank you.
I had a question about early teenage sex and personality development. I'd heard once upon a time that early sex at 12, 13, maybe even 14 would affect personality and perhaps even promiscuity later in life. Did you find any of that?
I think that parents didn't explicitly say that, but I think that is out there, and that forms part of parents' concern for their teen children. And certainly there is some research that suggests that teens who have sex at those preteen early ages or have, and sometimes that sex isn't necessarily wanted, that may in turn shape their later sexual experiences. But I don't think that we need to just assume that has to happen. I think that if we can find supports, resources, and just have a really open and honest dialogue that embraces these teens and helps them to know that you may have had sex early, you may have had sex in a context that wasn't exactly what you wanted or wasn't exactly how you imagined, but that doesn't mean that you're a bad person, and it doesn't mean that you need to have bad things to happen to you.
What do you see as the consequence of adults, not just parents, but authority figures in school who may be teaching these classes, talking only about the negative consequences of sex? What can go wrong there?
Well, we talk a lot about how bad sex is for teens and how bad things happen when teens have sex. But this means that when bad things happen or if bad sex happens, we have a ready-made explanation for it. See, you shouldn't have had sex. So I think that it means that teenagers don't feel as in control of what they're doing with their body.
Hmm.
And so I think that if we're actually giving young people a ton of information about sex and their bodies, then it can in some ways empower them to feel in control. And when you feel in control, you feel like you can make decisions that are in your interests. You feel more in charge of the situation.
Does a more neutral message from adults allow teenagers to feel like they can go to them if they do suffer a negative consequence? Coming back to that car example, it would be hard to imagine telling your kid, okay, but if you crash the station wagon, don't call me because I'm not taking you to the hospital.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I think so. And I think I spoke with a mother whose 15-year-old son had come to her. Her son was 16 when I spoke with her, but the year before, when he was 15, he had come to her and said, I had sex with my girlfriend, and I'm really worried that she's pregnant. And I thought it was really poignant that he had come to her in that way. But what I also thought was interesting was the way she described that sex. She said, you know, they were just kids exploring. Neither one of them had any experience. It just happened. And so she really kind of took away control and agency from her son in that situation.
Hmm.
And so even though I think it's great that he came to her, I'm not so sure that her response helped him to feel like he had some control over the situation.
Seneca Elliott is my guest. She's associate professor of sociology at North Carolina State University and author of the book Not My Kid, What Parents Believe About the Sex Lives of Their Teenagers. We'll talk more about this in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, get on the phone line now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is sociologist Seneca Elliott. Her new book is called Not My Kid, What Parents Believe About the Sex Lives of Their Teenagers. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Wanda on the line next in Dallas. Hi, Wanda.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I was just listening to your conversations and everything, talking about the children and their pregnancies. But what I talked to my son's friends who, you know, they don't want to ask their mom, so they came and were asking me what's wrong with them having sex with someone that they really love. I said, well, there's nothing wrong with the sex itself. It wouldn't have been such a strong urge. God created this. It's wonderful. The thing is, what happens after the sex? What happens after you have the child? You guys break up. Where's your baby? You know, if you get married again, does this child belong to you in this new mom? Is the person you're having sex with ready to be a mom? Are you going to be a dad for this child? You know, and they just kind of like in shock.
Mm.
So why doesn't anybody tell us this? My exact words says, nobody ever told us this. I said, well, that's what happens. It's not just like you have a baby and that's it. You know, you're responsible. People split up and the child has no mom, no dad. And that's the ramifications I'm talking about. And they were kind of, I'm sure they still went ahead and did things and maybe were a little cautious with birth control, which, you know, being a Catholic, but better than pregnancies. That's my opinion, but that's where I came from. And they were just kind of like, their mouth hit the floor. They said, nobody ever told us this. They just said we would be pregnant.
I think we've got it. And thank you very much. Do you want to respond to that, Seneca? Did you hear things like that from other parents?
Well, first, I just think it's great that her children's friends think that they have a resource in her and can talk with her.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that the parents told me, that they strongly get the impression from their own children that they don't want to have these conversations with their parents. And so I think it's great if teens feel as though there are other adults in their life that they can go to and talk with about these things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Anne, calling from Richardson. Hello, Anne.
Hey, talk about a perfect segue. What do you do if you have a teenager and you're not prepared to really talk to them about sexual matters? Is there any kind of reading material the author can recommend? I sent away for a Dear Abby booklet, and it's pretty explicit, so, you know, I'm not sure about that. What does she think?
Well, I will tell you that the expert advice is that you can't harm your child with too much information, and that learning about sex, about the mechanics, and these explicit details, it doesn't lead people to have sex. So I would like to reassure you in that regard. And I would just like also to reassure you that a lot of parents feel very awkward about having the conversation with their kids. And there are a ton of resources. I'm not going to single anyone out, because I think searching through those resources can actually be really helpful and reassuring for parents, because what you see is experts typically agree that we should be having these conversations, they should start early, and they should be ongoing. And they also agree that these conversations might be uncomfortable to have, because it's not an easy topic in our culture. So if you go to your local library and you look in the section on sex, you'll probably find a wealth of books, or your local bookstore. If you have access to the Internet, you can go online, search for Talking to Teens About Sex, and you'll get access to a ton of different online websites.
Did you hear from parents, Seneca, who said, I would like to talk to my kids about sex and about safe sex and what it all means, but I'm afraid that by doing that, I will be encouraging them to drop everything and become sexually active when they have not been before?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that parents, especially when I asked them the pleasure question, have you ever talked with them about pleasure? They said, well, that sounds like you're encouraging sex, and that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. But the research tells us that it's not the case, that simply talking about it doesn't encourage teens to do it. And in fact, I just want to point out again that sex is everywhere in our culture. It's not like kids aren't hearing about sex. Kids as young as 4, 5, they're seeing billboards, they're seeing commercials, TV shows, they're seeing images, and they're hearing about sex.
It's funny, because that's another thing, I guess, the denial issue that parents go through. People say, well, that went right over his head, or that went right over her head. They didn't understand that.
Yeah. Well, and some of it may not, but that's why, again, I'm a sociologist, and I'm not a sexual health educator, but that's why sexual health educators say, just keep having the conversations. It normalizes it, and this is about continuously bringing this into our everyday conversations, because it doesn't always stick the first time, and it may not always be entirely clear to a young person what we're telling them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Bill calling from Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Well, howdy. How's it going?
Great, thank you.
Chris, excellent show.
Thank you
very much. My question relates to long-range planning, and if your guest has had any experience with this and the effect it has. I come from a middle school where we started a project in 2005 having students write letters to themselves planning for 10 years into the future. And then that's stored in a vault in the school for a decade. Since we started doing this serious future planning, our pregnancy rate has more than cut in half.
Wow.
Have you had that type of experience?
That sounds like a really cool program that you started, and I'm delighted that you're seeing that it's actually improving the lives of your students. I think this is a big part of what parents worry about, that 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 their teens aren't thinking, they're not being future-oriented, they're not thinking towards the future. And I think doing these sorts of concrete exercises can really help teens to do that. And I also think helping teens to feel connected to their community, to feel like they're part of something bigger, and to feel really optimistic about their futures. And I think doing these sorts of exercises, these really concrete things, can be a part of that. I think that's great.
In defense of parents who, you know, we have the sense here that they're a little bit in denial, that they're maybe not accurately assessing the situation with their own kids. Kids work pretty hard to keep this information from their parents. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I want to emphasize, I don't think parents are in denial. I'm appalled that that some people have construed my research in that way. The parents that I spoke with told me that their teens are not interested in sex because they're telling their parents that. Hmm. And at the same time, they're telling their parents about all the things that their peers are doing. So I think they're kind of stoking their parents' anxieties about their peers at the same time that they're crafting their own selves as not interested in those things.
Did you have the sense at all that the teens who were telling their parents, oh, my friends are doing this, I'm not doing it, are maybe in a way that even they're not entirely aware of trying to reach out and start a conversation that ends up stalling?
That ends up stalling?
Well, in other words, if the kids are saying, Mom, I would never do this, but you ought to know that my best friend is doing this, this, and this. And parent, mom and dad walk away and go, well, thank God, they're not interested, and they see what a bad idea that is, and the conversation stops.
Ah, interesting. But in fact, that the teens themselves might actually be trying to generate a
right.
conversation.
Right.
That's great. I didn't actually talk with teens. I suspect that some of that may be going on, and teens may feel safer about kind of gauging their parents' attitudes by talking about their peers. So I think it's worthwhile for parents to think about that as their teens are talking about the things that their friends are doing, that they might also be looking for evidence of what are their parents' values about these things.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Jim's on the line in Flower Mound. Hi, Jim.
Hi, guys. Appreciate the conversation today. I just want to say I'm 72 years old. I'm a gay man. I was raised in East Texas. And all the time in my church or in my family, not one word is ever mentioned about sex. And I think, and then recently I went back to my home church, and on that day was the abstinence a group of young people, and these two gray-haired men got up in front of the church and read this pre-planned statement about how these kids should stay chastity. And I said, my God, why can't they bring some people up there that at least have some relationship to the kids? Anyway, that's my statement.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
What do you think, Seneca, about in terms of the people that we... If we know that our kids are not comfortable talking to us, or we've tried and failed, how do you sort of ensure that how do parents that you talk to try to ensure that their kids at least have some access to information?
Let's see. Some of the parents I talked with left books in their children's rooms. They said, I didn't want to have that conversation, and I didn't think I'd be very good at that conversation. Hmm. But I looked at some books, and I found one that I thought he could look at on his own, and then if he had questions, he could bring them to me. Some of the parents would watch TV with their kids, and if something came on, like 16 and pregnant, they felt like that might be an opportunity that they could casually say something, but not directing it at the teenager, him or herself. And some parents use joking, and I think humor goes a long way because humor is one way that we alleviate tension, and there is some tension about having these conversations. And I think it also kind of lightens the mood, and so that it doesn't feel quite so heavy. allows parents to engage with their teens more in an everyday kind of way.
As you know, in Texas, there remains a very big discussion and debate over what public schools should teach with regard to sex education. I was surprised that, by and large, the parents you spoke to who really ran the gamut politically and socially, most of them seem to agree that there ought to be some kind of education available for their kids in school.
Yeah, and this was something I was surprised by as well. But I really, the sex is not a black and white issue. So even parents with really strong beliefs about teen sexuality, really strong values, expressed a lot of uncertainty. If I can just tell you one story that I tell in the book, is about a father who identified as very conservative and a devout Catholic. And he's raising his three sons in the Catholic faith. And as he put it, condoms aren't part of that equation. But he and his wife use condoms to limit the number of children they have. And he told me he can't bring himself to tell his 14-year-old son this because it goes against his religious beliefs. But the fact of the matter is his son already knows he uses condoms because he's found them. And in fact, this father told me how he came home one day and he found his son trying on one of his condoms.
Hmm.
So he knows his son knows, but he feels very torn and conflicted, and he hadn't yet, at the time I interviewed him, talked with his son about contraception, other than to say that he's opposed to it. And so at the beginning of his interview, he said he really was opposed to school-based sex education. But about halfway through his interview, he said, you know, it's hard to admit, and he was referring to school-based sex education, but it's probably good that he's getting that information somewhere.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Are you optimistic that we're getting better at all this?
Am I optimistic? I think we are. Yes, I'll just say I am optimistic. I think, even though I think that these debates over what we teach teens, whether abstinence is realistic, whether we should be providing teens with information about contraception, these debates are at least one way that we're keeping this issue in the public discourse where it didn't used to be. It was very much more hidden away, I think. So even though parents are uncertain about what to say, they're confused, they're getting the message from their teens that they don't need this information, don't want it, aren't having sex, I still think that, yes, on a whole, sex and teens are increasingly part of our public discourse.
Seneca Elliott is Assistant Professor of Sociology at North Carolina State University and author of Not My Kid, What Parents Believe About the Sex Lives of Their Teenagers. Seneca, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast every day online at kera.org/think. Think at kera.org is the email address for comments, questions, or suggestions. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.